Welcome to the Friday night main speaker meeting at the 31st World Convention of NA. My name is Daniel. I'm an addict from Germany. Have you seen this video? Great, wasn't it? What a start. So, tonight we have two great speakers and also a very, very special presentation by members of the Japanese NA community. So be sure to stay for all of that. But first, can we open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the power to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay. We will do the readings now. First, we have Kirk from Hawaii, who will read to us who is an addict.
My name's Kirk. I'm a grateful recovering addict. And this is who is an addict. Most of us do not have to think twice about this question. We know our whole life and thinking was centered in drugs in one form or another, getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. We live to use and use to live. Very simply, an addict is a man or woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same, jails, institutions, and death. And we shall be. Thank you.
And we have Beatrice from Greece read for us what's the NA program in Greece. What else?
Hello, my name is Beatrice. I'm from Greece. And I'm an addict. And I will read what is the NA program.
Τι είναι το πρόγραμμα Ναρκωμανείς Ανώνυμοι. Το ΝΑΑ είναι μια μη κερδοσκοπική αδερφότητα ή κοινωνία ανδρών και γυναικών για τους οποίους τα ναρκωτικά είχαν γίνει κύριο πρόβλημα. Είμαστε ναρκωμανείς ανάρρωσοι που συναντιόμαστε τακτικά για να βοηθήσουμε ένας τον άλλο να παραμείνουμε καθαροί. Είναι ένα πρόγραμμα πλήρους αποχής από όλα τα ναρκωτικά. Υπάρχει μόνο μία προϋπόθεση για να είναι κανείς μέλος, η επιθυμία να σταματήσει να κάνει χρήση. Προτείνουμε να είστε ανοιχτόμυαλοι και να δώσετε στον εαυτό σας μια ευκαιρία. Το πρόγραμμά μας είναι ένα σύνολο αρχών που είναι γραμμένες τόσο απλά ώστε να μπορούμε να τις ακολουθούμε στην καθημερινή μας ζωή. Το πιο σημαντικό είναι ότι έχουν αποτέλεσμα. Δεν υπάρχουν δεσμεύσεις στον ΙΑΛΦΑ, δεν συνδεόμαστε με κανέναν άλλο οργανισμό, δεν έχουμε έξοδα εγγραφή στις συνδρομές, εγγύησεις να υπογράψουμε, υποσχέσεις να δώσουμε σε κανέναν. Δεν συνδεόμαστε με καμία πολιτική, θρησκευτική ή νομική παράταξη και δεν είμαστε ποτέ υπό επιτήρηση. Οποιοδήποτε μπορεί να συνδεθεί μαζί μας, άσχετα από ηλικία, φυλή, σεξουαλική ταυτότητα, δόγμα, θρησκεία ή έλλειψη θρησκείας. Δεν μας απασχολεί το τι ή πόσο έπαιρνες, ποιες ήταν οι διασυνδέσεις σου, τι έχεις κάνει στο παρελθόν, ποια είναι η οικονομική σου κατάσταση, αλλά μόνο το τι θες να κάνεις για το πρόβλημά σου και πώς μπορούμε να βοηθήσουμε. Ο νεοφερμένος είναι το σπουδαιότερο πρόσωπο σε οποιαδήποτε συγκέντρωση, επειδή μπορούμε να διατηρήσουμε αυτό που έχουμε μόνο χαρίζοντάς το. Έχουμε μάθει από την ομαδική μας εμπειρία ότι αυτοί που συνεχίζουν να έρχονται τακτικά συγκεντρώσεις μας μένουν καθαροί.
And we have Jimmy from Sweden reading to us why are we here.
Hi, I'm Jimmy and I'm an addict. Why are we here? Innan vi kom till NAs gemenskap kunde vi inte hantera våra egna liv. Vi kunde inte leva och glädja oss åt livet som andra människor gör. Vi måste ha något annorlunda och vi trodde att vi hade funnit det i droger. Vi satte användningen av dessa före våra familjers, fruars, äkta mäns och våra barns välfärd. Vi måste ha droger till varje pris. Vi tillfogade många människors stor skada. men mest av allt så skadade vi oss själva. Genom vår oförmåga att ta personligt ansvar så skapade vi i själva verket våra egna problem. Vi verkade oförmögna att möta livet på dess egna villkor. De flesta av oss insåg att vi i vårt beroende långsamt gick självmord. Men beroendet är en så slug fiende till livet att vi hade förlorat förmågan att göra något åt det. Många av oss hamnade i fängelse eller sökte medicinsk, religiös eller psykiatrisk hjälp. Ingen av dessa metoder var tillräcklig för oss. Vår sjukdom kom alltid upp till ytan igen eller fortsatte att utvecklas tills vi i förtvivlan sökte hjälp hos varandra i anonyma narkomaner. Efter att ha kommit till NA insåg vi att vi var sjuka människor. Vi led av en sjukdom som inte har något känt botemedel. Den kan dock hejdas i ett visst skede och tillfrisknande är sedan möjligt. Thank you.
And last but not least, Belinda from Australia, how it works.
Hello, my name is Belinda. I'm an addict. How it works. If you want what we have to offer and are willing to make the effort to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. These are the principles that made our recovery possible. One, we admitted that we were powerless over our addictions, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, we admitted to God, to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, we continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. This sounds like a big order and we can't do it all at once. We didn't become addicted in one day, so remember, easy does it. There is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. Three of these that are indispensable are honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. With these, we are well on our way. We feel that our approach to the disease of addiction is completely realistic, for the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. We feel that our way is practical, for one addict can best understand and help another addict. We believe that the sooner we face our problems within our society in everyday living, just that much faster do we become acceptable, responsible and productive members of that society. The only way to keep from returning to active addiction is not to take that first drug. If you are like us, you know that one is too many and a thousand never enough. We put great emphasis on this, for we know that when we use drugs in any form or substitute one for another, we release our addiction all over again. Thinking of alcohol as different from other drugs has caused a great many addicts to relapse. Before we came to NA, many of us viewed alcohol separately, but we cannot afford to be confused about this. Alcohol is a drug. We are a people with the disease of addiction who must abstain from all drugs in order to recover.
Okay. Well, I don't understand you anyway. I'm German, you know. And I'm serious. I don't hear it out of the crowd. You know, like, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay. We're happy that you did hear. Thank you. Thank you. actually, I got through this here like a virgin to a child, like we say back home, just an hour ago. I've been told that I have to do it here, and I'm quite nervous, and also I'm not a native speaker. That doesn't make it any better. So I ask you for helping me a little, and you know, not making this a nervous place here, because I'm nervous anyway, and I would like, if I'm nervous here and you're nervous down there, it doesn't work. So I would ask you, you know, to be as quiet as you can. That would help me and later on the speakers as well. So if some of the sentences you may hear out of my voice don't make any sense to you, that is absolutely normal. This is my inability of expressing myself. But I need to point out, in my mother language, I am very articulated. I'm very proud of it. So, before I did it here, you know, and like I said, just know it for a couple of minutes, I called my wife, which is 12 hours ahead of us, you know, which was a half an hour ago, so called her very early in the morning, and I said, guess what they've done to me, you know? And she said, how could they? And I said, I don't know. But the good thing is, I called her for a reason. And the reason was to give me confidence somehow. I just asked her, do you think I can stand it? And she said, sure you can. I'm married with her for 21 years, and or marriage to her, I think, would be appropriate. Huh? Anyway, it's the same thing, 21 years. And I still love her. When I came to Narcotics Anonymous, it was like a secret little thing. You know, we had about 4 to 5 meetings in Germany and nobody knew of each other. So, well, at this time I said, by accident I ran into this very few meetings. You know, today I call it, actually it was, there was a reason behind it. But at the time I thought, yeah, I was a lucky bastard and I just had this lucky time. And realizing first time in my life that there is a chance that I get older than 25. You know, I thought, what should I do with this spare time? Means, if, you know, if I don't get caught by a deadly disease, that means there are 20, 30, 40, if I get worth 50 years more to live. What should I do with this time, if this is possible? And then I made a little plan. And the plan was like, you know, I have this little frog in front of here. He's from England, you know, and I do service with him for years. And he's all like, wah, 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 making me nervous, you know, giving me sense, giving me shit, teaching me proper, decent English and all this kind. And that's what he's doing now, you know. As if I wouldn't be nervous enough by now. Thank you, David, for sharing with me. What I wanted to say is actually, coming back to the list, I had this list in mind, what do you do with the next decade? And I thought, a family, a house, kids, good car, decent job, coming rich, whatever, you know this list. And I've been fortunate enough to get all this done on the list, but there was a thing which wasn't on my list. And this is the feeling and the life I have today. I didn't know that there is something which is called a fulfilling life. You know, where you actually don't need all this material shit, even if you don't have it or not. The only thing you need is to be able to love and being loved. That's all I need. And it wasn't on my list, but I have it in my life, and I would change it for nothing. So, yeah, I'm about introducing our speakers now, which is a gentleman from England, Martin. May I hear a hand or what? Actually, I know him for quite a long time, more than 20 years. I haven't seen him. We just figured when was the last time we saw each other, and it was really a long time ago. But this is the special thing about NA. You have people all over the world, and some of them, they just rest in your heart, and you're lucky you see them again, and some not, but they're still in your heart. And this is a very good example of, you know, having not seen somebody for a long time, but then seeing him again and, you know, enjoying that, just meeting him for a couple of minutes. But now he's going to come up here and share with us. Martin from UK.
I'm Martin, I'm an addict. Can everybody hear me okay? It's the first time I've got off a park bench where I felt very comfortable to speak to a crowd like this. When you're back there, you can't hear or see, so it's pretty much like being in active addiction. What I'd like to be able to share with you, really, I'm in a bit of panic. I haven't prepared anything. I've only got my story. And just before we came on, I was told that we're only speaking for about 20 minutes. So, although there was nothing really prepared, I don't know why I'm really panicking. It should be better for me, but somehow it doesn't feel like it is. I think what I was hoping was, are you getting the echo, or is it just me getting an echo? Okay, well, I can live with that. I've been getting it years. Yeah, I think the problem for me is that when my fear is really activated, which drives my addiction, all my outriders are trying to regain some control and to feel safe, and I was hoping to speak a little bit slowly and not rush so that my higher power can really cut in. So now I'm going to have to accelerate that a little bit. The only thing I'm going to try and control is my bad language and my bladder and my bowels. That's it. I was going to pretend this was like my, you know, it's really just like a local meeting except with 6,000 people in it. You know, it's a big room, this. Yes, I don't think I've been in such a big room. Anyway, I've got 20 minutes to tell my story, and it's obviously impossible. So I feel that the debt that I have for the rest of my life is to Narcotics Anonymous. The duty that maybe I have and the responsibility that goes with it is to maybe help one person discover what's possible in this fellowship, or to help somebody touch another soul. And I'd like to, first of all, just as I'm calming down, thank a couple of people I've met here, Marissa, Gloria from Baltimore, this is from the Bronx, and the people in the marathon meeting at 4 o'clock this morning, which really reminded me about what NA is about. And there's a woman there that I really wanted to go and hug, who shared her pain, and I didn't get that opportunity. So if you were in there, I'd really like to give you a hug later. But that's what really connected me, because I suffer from a disease which disconnected me. My addiction was all about disconnection. And in the brief period I've got to let you know about my story, there's one thing I'd like you to try and do, which is to try and let go of all your expectations. I'm trying to let go of my expectations of what your expectations are of me. And I tell you why I mention that, because whenever I've had expectations, which I've had most of my life, they were pretty well based around the world view, based around Disney or something. I wasn't very realistic, but I've always had expectations. But what my experience has been is disappointment follows very quickly. When I went to my first NA meeting, it was the first time, I think, in my life that I had no expectations. I was completely broken as a human being. I really stood on this sort of edge of my life, looking into the abyss. I wasn't dead, but I certainly wasn't alive. And in that, because I knew, I didn't know what to expect, because I was so lost, I became very open. And because I became very open, I was able to feel the love that was in that room. My expectations robbed me from feeling very often anything. But I wanted to share with you really my early recovery. The end of my using, which was no fixed abode, completely alone. I was told by the medical profession that I was a hopeless case, and I'm afraid there was nothing more they could do for me. What they did say before my last admission into another institution, and there were very few treatment centres, and what they did say was there was a guy called Johnny who's passed away since, clean, who set up an organisation called NA. Obviously he hadn't, but that's the information that was given to me. And that's how NA was born in London, with a few people. And I always remembered, and he gave me this guy's phone number. And at the end of my using, when I was discharged from this locked mental ward again, I had made the decision really to die. My last great enabler, my mother, died through the pain, really, of not wanting to bury her son. And I had these two carrier bags that I used to walk around in. In the London Fellowship, that's all Martin and his two carrier bags. There was nothing in them, really. The grandiosity, even at that stage, I had one carrier bag with the letters from my ex-wife telling me she's left me, and she was in a treatment centre. And I think the other bag was just junk. But I really was sort of orphaned into NA, and I didn't come expecting anything. My life was finished, and it was just a question of when it was going to finish. I think when I got to that meeting, if it would have been a day earlier, it may have been too soon. And if it was a day later, it may have been too late. The timing, I just can't tell you, was just so perfect. And in that meeting, there was only about six people. We had about 15 meetings a week in London when I came in. There's 8 million people live in London, so you can work out how many addicts there. Plenty. And halfway through that meeting, in fact, before that, there was a guy came up to me and he said, "Welcome, would you like a cup of tea?" And it had been so long since anybody had ever said welcome or invited me in or felt, you know, I almost instantly felt at home, and I was obviously looking for the scam or the clue or what this whole thing was about. And then halfway through the meeting, I saw a girl that I'd used with. She was 6 months clean. she thought I'd died. And after that meeting, I cried the whole night through. I realized in a moment that everything I was ever going to need to know was there. I can't tell you how that happened. I don't know the detail, but I knew that everything I was looking for all my life was there, in a place of no expectation, in a community center where I wouldn't have been seen dead in normally. And here was the secret of life, disguised in this kind of run-down little building, half a dozen addicts. And I was very grandiose. I've searched all over the world for the secret of life. I've been married before, a couple of times. I look for the secret in life in women, in drugs, in anything. And it was in this strange, grubby little building with these six addicts. And the fire was just lit within me. I was kind of really at such a rock bottom. I just wanted to share that this early period of recovery. I mean, I've been around now 20 years. In June 1st was my birthday. But what I, and it's incredible that I'm standing on a stage at 20 years, because what I want to share with you is that I stood on a stage 20 years ago in London, before the World Convention in London, and it feels very symbolic that it's just kind of neat and tidy, which is how I'd like it. I wish my life was like that. So they said to me, go to a meeting every day. And I was living in this kind of, I was homeless, and I was in this sort of hostel where they weren't very nice people, and it was really filthy and dirty, and I just want to share these couple of things that happened in 2 days. After about a week or so of going to meetings, I was going backwards to this little place, and I had no money. And this place used to say, it was what we call in England a bed and breakfast. You got your bed and two slices of toast, and that's it. That was breakfast. And because I defrauded the Social Security before I got clean, they wouldn't make any payments, and they said they were going to throw me out. And I met a woman that morning. She stood out, really, because she was older, she was quite well dressed, and there was something about her. And she came and sat with me at breakfast and over the slice of toast, and she said, you're a Pisces and you're going through a spiritual experience. And I thought, yeah, you know, another crazy woman. Went to try and get my money, and they refused to give it to me. And I crept back in so that they wouldn't throw me out. And I sat on my bed in this grubby little room. But I knew an NA meeting was all I needed. I had it on the walls. I stuck up stuff saying, a meeting every day. An NA meeting's all you need the rest of your life. An NA meeting's all you need. And I felt this kind of energy. And I looked up, and under the door was this kind of, was a note. And on this note, I got up and I looked at it. And it said, if you need to speak, knock on my room. And, you know, I didn't have a better plan, which was fantastic, because I normally have, but my plans had run out. The end of my using, really, was when I ran out of plans. The script writers that sat in my head for 17 years telling me that everything was, this was the next move, this is the one that's going to sort it all out, and vacated the space. There was nothing left to write. And I knocked on her door. I assumed it was the woman from the morning. She opened the door, and there was all these kind of icons in this, these religious figures. And she stood there and she said, God sent me to help you. And I'm quite cynical. And she said, come in and talk. And I went in and I had a chat and I said, look, I found these people and I need to go to meetings and I just need my rent paid and I need my fare money and, you know, that's... And she said, well, I'm going to pay 2 weeks' rent, give you some money to get to your meetings. And I never saw her again. I stayed there for a few days and I looked for her, but she was gone. Now, I don't know how this stuff happens or what happened. I can't explain it. That's been my experience. The next day, or a few days later, I just want to share these two, what I would have to regard as miracles. I mean, the first miracle was I wasn't using. That was the real miracle. And she gave me some money, which obviously I wasn't very good with money, to last me for 2 weeks, which lasted me for 2 days. Because I had good breakfast and I kind of... And that financial irresponsibility has followed me through my recovery and caused me countless pain. Only recently have I started to address my relationship to money and being irresponsible and the pain that it's caused me. But I'm somebody that kind of needs a lot of pain. I don't know why. Because if it doesn't get painful, I don't change anything. And I'm a great believer that when it's painful enough, I stop doing the things that create that pain. But the threshold's enormous, I've got to tell you. Anyway, I'd run out of money and there was only one meeting on a Sunday in London. I was desperate to get to it. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I was up early in the morning and was hungry again. It's hard to believe, looking at me now, that I was so hungry. I've never eaten for 20 years, but I'm sure a few people can identify with that. I was hungry, I needed cigarettes, and my pride, this thing that this phenomenon called my pride, that stopped me asking for help for so many years, I was walking towards a phone box and I thought I'd phone the one person who had sent me in some cigarettes when I was in detox and in prison. But I didn't want to wake him up on a Sunday morning and ask for money. But then my head was saying, go on, you know, you need some help, you can't hang around for 6 hours. And I walked into this phone box. It was outside a tube station in London. And I picked up the receiver and my head was battling, shall I phone? And I picked up the receiver and money started to pour out the phone box. But not a little bit of money. The whole phone box emptied on the floor. Until it was embarrassing. I was frightened people would think I'm robbing it. And the phone box emptied. And I don't know how that happened. That was my experience. You know, I went back there every day for a week, but it never happened again. So before I really understood a higher power or a God of my own understanding, my higher power thought we're going to give this man some faith and some trust and a whole lot of hope. And that's exactly what I got very early on. And from then on, I suppose my whole life has been centered in and around NA. And the bit I want to share, because I forgot to look when I started sharing, which is a shame. Can we do the 20 minutes from now? I'm feeling a bit better. But this is kind of for the hope for the newcomers. I really enjoyed this kind of strange fellowship. I couldn't find out who was in charge. I couldn't find out. And we'd not had much contact with the US fellowship. And there was a meeting announced at the end of the meeting that there's an ad, we want to form a bid committee meeting for the Washington World Convention in 1985 to make a bid to hold the 1986 World Convention in London. And I said, I'll do it. So we all went to this meeting and I was a couple of months clean. Yeah. Yeah, but I think the kind of moral of the tale is addicts can do anything. You know, there's nothing. I think the only thing we can't do is destroy this fellowship, as many of us have tried to do in our own way. And anyway, we had this big committee meeting, and the people with the big clean time had about a year, maybe 15 months, 16 months, and Washington, and I hadn't left the country for years, you know, I couldn't leave town for years. And they did minutes, and in the minutes it said, Martin said, let's go for it. And for me to see those minutes with my name on it, and kind of, Martin said, let's go for it, and we went for it. And they said, who wants to find a venue? We need a convention center. So I'll do it. So at 2 months clean, I'm going to meetings, I'm running around, I'm mixing with people, I'm feeling fantastic, I'm feeling everything I'd always dreamt I could feel. Maybe beyond what I could dream. I couldn't dream you could feel like that. And I, you know, where do you start looking as an addict? You know, you've got to hire a convention centre, you've got to get a bid together. So we only got a couple of big venues in London, and it was Wembley, and I phoned them up and I spoke to someone. I said, look, I'm just doing the footwork. I'm from an organisation. We need to hire your building. So they said, well, come down and see us. And I stood on this stage. I was a fantastic con artist anyway. I mean, I'm still pretty good like that. You wouldn't have known I was 2 months clean. Well, they wouldn't have known. You would have known. They wouldn't have known. Yeah. And they met me like royalty, and I had the guy in charge and his deputy and this one and that one, and I kind of dressed it all up a bit. You know, there's a lot of people coming in from the States. And anyway, I stood on this stage, and it was like this, and I was 2 months clean, and there was this empty auditorium, kind of probably a bit smaller than this, but round, and but with a balcony, and I stood at the podium like this. And I closed my eyes, and I knew that we would win the bid, and I knew that in a year later, I'd be standing on that stage, over a year clean. I kind of knew that in a minute with the World Convention, and that's kind of what happened. So, you know, don't let your clean time stop you. Because my recovery has been about passion. It's what it's really been about. It's about coming back to life. It's about passion. And it's about believing that anything is possible. Because the impossible's already happened by the fact that I'm not using. Daniel. Anyway, we got that bid, and we had the World Convention, and then we started to get lots of people in from the States trying to take over. That was my deal. But they had a big fight on with me there, I'm telling you. Because this was my fellowship, I was very protective, very suspicious. But what I saw was a whole bunch of people came, some that are here today, some who are not. And I saw the way, and they had some time, and they treated me especially, and I'm sure everybody else, with a lot of love and respect. That's what really helped me to realize what an enormous thing we've got here. The experience that was won in the US, the fellowship was quite mature, even though the basic text, I think, was only released about 3 years earlier. But they came and they understood my fears and my kind of difficulties, and there was the stuff around the money. What do you mean you want some of the money? That was kind of a problem. But I started to understand. People were really patient with me. They were really patient with me. And I mean, since then, I was thinking about the journey. It's so impossible to talk about 20 years in 20 minutes. But there was a lot of things I learned early on, and after a couple of years clean and getting sponsored, which was a miracle because I started interviewing women to sponsor me, really. Because they said you'd find somebody who's got what you want, but the truth is I was more comfortable around women. You know, I was a womanizer. A baby still am. Although I'm beautifully, happily married to a wonderful woman at the moment. Hayley is back in the UK, and she's due to share at St. Patrick's Church an hour after I finish here in the UK. It's 11 hours ahead. And she's taught me so much about respecting women. My attitude was bad. My attitude was bad about everything. But maybe I'll get a minute to talk about that later. But I was just going to talk about an experience I had in Europe when my sponsor, who was this kind of mad Frenchman, living in London. And people loved me enough to say, listen, I couldn't find a sponsor. I was talking to this woman, that woman, this woman. They said, listen, the guy you need is sharing on step 10 tonight. Get there. And they sort of made sure I got there. And I heard this guy share, and I loved him. I just wanted what I understood. And anyway, a little while later, he said to me, you know, I'll sponsor you if you're willing to go to any lengths. Which is what I tell all my sponsees. If you're willing to go any lengths, that's fine. If not, then I can't. And he wanted to go look about a year later in Paris for his sister, using in Paris. There was one NA meeting in Paris. City, I don't know how big Paris is, a couple of million people. He said, we've got to go find my sister. And they're also opening a step meeting, the first step meeting in Paris. We never found a sister, but what I discovered on that trip was this step meeting was held in French. I don't speak French. The whole meeting was in French, and then they had a group conscience to see if they could allow me to share in English. I think what staggered me was I came out of that meeting feeling exactly the same as a meeting where I understood every word. There was something beyond the words. The words, sometimes, the less you say, the more you say. I was very clever with words. I used words for years to rationalize, to justify, to manipulate especially, to exploit, to try and fix that hole in the soul. When I came out of that meeting in Paris, I thought there's something, I couldn't understand it. It was the love. I knew it must have been the love. The fact that French addicts, because the French women were in my fourth step, I just realized, I don't know where that came from. French women were in my fourth step because I'd never slept with a French woman. That was under groups, when I was doing groups. Because, and the fact is, I never even knew a French woman, so. But it went to show how I don't need much to resent anybody or a group of people. You know, straight away, French women, 20 million people, gone. That's it. Resent a lot. My whole inventory with the. When I looked at the inventory, the reason I felt so lonely and isolated was I resented everybody I'd met in my life, and I resented everybody I hadn't met in my life. That's why I was so lonely. I mean, just using European, I was just thinking, because Daniel's German, you'll remember, when did the Berlin Wall come down? 1989. I remember coming home from work. This is just an illustration of my self-centeredness. 1989, I'm 4 years clean. Get in, put the news on. There's all these mad scenes in Germany, Berlin walls coming down, 40 million people being freed from an oppressive regime. What's my first thought? I don't need this right now. My life was going really well. Things were stable. And then, what a beautiful gift. I've been given so many illustrations of those ridiculous proportions that have really slowly helped me for the penny to drop. Okay. I mean, NA's really been so patient and loving with me that I thought many times of doing a rehearsal before I come here, and I did do some, and it was very painful. You know, do I go through the steps and give you the definitive lecture on every single step, and do I... I don't know why... Because I'm trying to, I suppose, be quite light-hearted about things, but I've been through some real difficult stuff in recovery. My little brother died of cancer. He wasn't an addict, and we were very close, and he was the only family I had left about 10 years ago. I was completely overwhelmed with pain. I stayed with him for the 3 weeks he was dying, and saw him every day, and I got to say, could see the beauty in the dying process. But even as he was dying, the self-centeredness again. I was kind of standing there, saying, "Andy, you know, I wish it was me. I want to kill myself. I really can't." And he said, "Hang on, Martin. It's a bummer for me. I'm dying. I'm going to be." And I love him so much, and it was really sad, and he was such a courageous, lovely guy, because I can't really make sense out of why I've been spared. The only thing that makes sense to me, or that gives me some semblance of making some sense of my life, is to give back. My character defects have worked both ways. I'll just kind of finish on this, because I'd like to say I've also had the joy. I mean, the thing after my brother's death was I had a problem in meetings because my pain and my grief felt too private. But my prison commitment to the meeting I ran every Tuesday night got me through it. For some reason, I couldn't let the boys down. I couldn't not go to that prison meeting. Even though it was easier to not go to fellowship meetings, that prison meeting got me through. So that kind of service commitment really worked for me. I'm sort of struggling a little bit because I've got so much I want to say, and I know I've got about 5 minutes, if that. My character defects have kind of worked both ways. They've destroyed me, not made me use. But through one of them, my pride, the stuff that was really affecting me before I came on, that fear of being rejected, the fear of being judged, and the ultimate fear I had as being a kid, the fear of humiliation. Especially in front of 6,000 people. Bad enough in front of one person. But I met a woman. A woman came into my life. I had a sponsee who was obsessed with this woman. I was sponsoring him. And I said, forget it. She ain't going to make it. She's not got the commitment. She hasn't got what it takes. 4 years later, I married her. And that's when I stop working out who's going to make it and who's not going to make it. Just to let you know about how my pride works, I've shared this with my wife, so she won't mind. She's an angel. She's a real angel. I didn't want to get married. Because I said, when I got clean, after a couple of weeks, the only thing I'm not going to do, I'm going to stay in this fellowship. The only thing I'm not going to do is get married again. But my pride, this is how kind of distorted my thinking is, the pride and the vanity. I got to a stage about 4 years clean. I was living alone, very boundaried. Nobody can ring Martin after 8:30. Nobody can ring his doorbell. Very controlled environment. And I thought, what happens if I have a heart attack and die in the night? And my pride projected this decomposed body with my private parts probably displayed. I don't know why probably, but maybe. Sounds a bit premeditated otherwise, doesn't it? And it was that pride I thought I really got to... That was what inspired me. I wanted to ask her, but I kind of thought, I need to live with someone. And that was the reason that I kind of made the commitment. Was my the vanity and the pride of not wanting to die alone and be discovered by some police breaking the door down. That really inspired me. But really this woman inspired me tremendously. And I asked her to marry me, and it was the most beautiful thing. We flew to Barbados, and I went with my sponsor and two of my sponsees, and we did our own service on the beach at sunset. And over the years, she's taught me so much about respecting women, about valuing women. And she takes no nonsense from me. She gets plenty, but she takes none. She's been fantastically supportive while I've been here. You know, it's a long way from home. And I don't know why I feel... I've got this problem. I very rarely can say how much I love her when I'm with her. I can never really say how grateful I am to her when I'm near her. I'm normally finding fault. I'm normally finding the one thing that's not right. So I kind of can sort of address that now. I think to wind up with, I'm very grateful. I forgot to thank the committee and go through the... the list of gratitude to various people, but it's been a real privilege to be able to share something of my life with you. It feels not enough, but it's a message of hope. And at the end of my days, I kind of feel that if I've helped as many people as I've hurt in my life, I'll be very grateful for that. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Take your seat and quiet down because we have another speaker. 20 million, not 40, got out of the cage in 89. Our next speaker is Randy from Texas. And I like...
I'm an addict. My name's Randy. I can't tell you how grateful I am to be here. This is such an honor, and I'm so grateful to the committee for asking me to come here. to Hawaii, to this beautiful state. The surroundings are just gorgeous, and I just eat it up. I love this. I dreamed as a child of coming to Hawaii, and I thought, well, I'll never get to make it there. And this is my second time here. And dreams can come true when you stay clean. I've been clean since June 10th in 1987. I'm very grateful for that as well. And I love this theme of one fellowship, many friends, because I have so many friends out there. A friend just brought me this, and I'm just surrounded by friends. I never had friends before. I didn't know what a friend was. And friendship is awesome, and I still get to pick up friends along the way. I make new ones all the time that I want to nurture that friendship and make it more than what it is. And that's an honor. That's a privilege as an individual to be able to cultivate that. It takes work. I don't take friendship for granted. I was born in Dallas, Texas in 1953. And that makes me 52. And that's amazing, too. I never thought I'd live this long. I got married for the first time when I was 18 to get out of the house. Not because it was a bad place, but because I didn't know any other way. I came from a very loving Jewish family. My parents never divorced. They were married 65 years. And they were great role models. They spoiled me. I have two older brothers. And we were just a very loving family, and still are. Some of us, the ones that are still around. I got married, and my life turned to people. I was surrounded by people who were smugglers and dealers, and I had already used years before. You know, I'd never felt like I fit in anywhere. I never felt good enough, never felt smart enough. I hated school. I thought if you found out how scared I was and that I didn't know what you knew, that you wouldn't like me. And that's how I went through life. So when I got married, and you know, I'd been doing drugs already to escape, I thought it was a very social thing. But when I look back at the magnitude of what I was doing and how it progressed, I had the addiction from the get-go. I also thought I'd found the life to suit my style, though. You know, I liked that escape. I liked not having to suit up and show up and step up to the plate and be an achiever. I liked being laid back and getting high. I enjoyed that. I had no direction. I got divorced 4.5 years later. Things got really insane. And I went back to Mommy and Daddy's. They were always there for me. I was in several businesses with my dad, from furniture to gambling. Run the gamut of everything. They were always there for me. And I like that, and I don't like that. It didn't allow me to become an adult soon enough, I guess. But, you know, things happen in God's time. My addiction progressed, and, you know, I was searching all the time for where I fit in, and many failed relationships because I didn't know how to do those very well, and I'd stay in them a lot longer than I needed to because I never knew how to get out of one either. I ended up moving to New York, and my addiction just really took off there. I had like this newfound freedom of not being in my hometown, and I was off and running. And naturally, the guy I was living with up there was a drug dealer, and I just fit right in. I ended up moving back. Things got really insane, and then I went back for more insanity and more degradation. I crossed every line in my disease that I said I wouldn't cross, those imaginary lines that we have that I'm never going to do this, and it's not that bad, and it was. I ended up coming back to Dallas, and my brother had come to NA, and I'm sure he suggested it at the time. He'd been in a short while, and he was, you know, really head over heels about this fellowship, and he was, you know, really sick. I guess I thought, you know, I didn't have what he had. And my ears were not open at the time. And about 2.5 years later, I was ready. A friend of mine, her brother had gone to treatment, I just got clean. You know, it inspired me that I wanted to do what he was doing, not necessarily what my brother was doing, but I called my brother and said, would you take me to a meeting? And that was awesome that I had him to turn to, and still do to this day. Family's really important to me. You know, I had OD'd, I'd almost died so many times, but I kept wanting to keep using to fill that hole. I didn't know how to live another way. But when I came in these rooms, I found another way. I found the tools. Y'all gave me the tools necessary. I heard you had to get a sponsor, or it was suggested that you get a sponsor and you work these steps. And the steps scared me. I looked up there and I saw that G word, and I just didn't know how that was going to fit in my life, because I didn't think that God had been with me. And I didn't know how I'd find him. And, you know, this fellowship gave me the tools to find a higher power that loves me so much, that's up here with me today. And it's weird. I really haven't been nervous. I was nervous last week, and I haven't been nervous. And everybody keeps asking me, are you nervous? Are you nervous? And I'm really not. It's an honor to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope that, you know, no matter what you've done, that one day you can feel comfortable in your own skin, because I never had my whole life. And through working the steps and taking these suggestions from a sponsor, it just happened. You know, it's a miracle the way the steps work. I got into service really early. I was a service junkie. I loved it. I wanted to go to everything. I loved to go to conventions. I'd go anywhere I could go with a group of people to go to conventions. And then I got married again. And about 9 months later, I had a child. I was 39 when I had my child. And I thought that I needed to quit all my service to be, you know, this super mom. And I did not know how to be a mom. I called women in the fellowship going, what do I do? How do I do this? You know, I reached out. And, you know, one day at a time, I'm still working on being the best mom that I can be. My husband was in the program, and life went on. I pulled back out of service, and my life got kind of scary. You know, I'd quit going to as many meetings, quit doing the service, and I was real unbalanced. So I got into H&I, and I was taking a meeting to the out to the county jail where I live, and I loved doing it. And then one day someone said, well, there's a women's prison about a little more than 2.5 hours away, and they don't have any meetings. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to help them get some meetings. So I called, made all these phone calls, and I've been taking meetings, coordinating the meetings to the women's prison in Gatesville, Texas, for the last 8 years. And it's the most awesome thing that I do. I mean, I've got a group of friends, a group of women that go with me on the first Saturday of every month. Sometimes there's 15 of us that caravan down there, and we come from throughout our region sometimes. And we shop and we fellowship with each other. And I've made friends there that I would have not met these women in our fellowship any other way but through service. And that's how I've made a lot of friends. It's through giving back this fellowship. And stuff happens on the side that, you know, I didn't set out to do. You know, God's in charge, and he has this plan. And while I'm off doing one thing, you know, all these other things are being worked out. And like I said, that's been the most awesome thing in my recovery. And I still do it today. And we're picking up new women all the time to go. And it's a great attraction, and we have a great time. On March 6, 1999, we were down there like we always were on the first Saturday of the month. And in the first meeting, I got a really bad headache and felt really weird. And I was sharing even. We just opened the meeting, and I quit sharing, and I scooted back, and I called someone out, and I said, I don't feel good. Something's really wrong. And she said, well, it sounds like you have a migraine from what you're describing. And the cooks are coming out of the kitchen and offering me aspirin. I said, I don't think that's going to help. And they decided that, you know, I needed to be driven back home. So we drove 90 miles an hour all the way home. I was in the fetal position in the back seat, just hyperventilating, and had my husband call the doctor. You know, I'm going to the hospital. I've got this migraine, and, you know, I need a shot or something. And I got there, and what seemed like an eternity, but several hours later, after many tests, they figured out I'd had a brain aneurysm, and it had burst and sealed in my head, and I didn't die, which is a miracle. And I felt like it was somebody else's life this was happening to. All of a sudden, you know, they're wheeling me around. They're taking my son places. People are showing up, family's showing up, and I'm freaking out. And this doctor comes in and says, you know, I'm going to have to shave your head. I'm doing surgery on you 7:30 in the morning, and he did. I was supposed to be there like a week to 10 days, and the following Saturday, I was at home. This fellowship was so awesome. The prayers that went out throughout the world and the flowers that came, I can't ever express enough gratitude for what I felt and the healing that that gave me. And, you know, I went back to work after 6 weeks. I'm perfectly fine. You know, 5% of people die from even having one, and then only 5% come out okay. And, you know, after that, you find about all these people that it's happened to their relatives and they died. And, you know, I just feel really blessed that, you know, I'm still here today. And I couldn't wait to get back to the prison and continue to take meetings. What service has done for me is allowed me to be part of the, you know, I say I go from the H&I to PTA. You know, I get to be involved in my son's life. It taught me the tools that I needed to go out in the world and mix with these people that some days I still feel less than. I still feel like, you know, they don't have this disease and I do. I feel like it's a good thing that I have this disease most of the time. I feel, you know, really blessed that, you know, I feel like I'm chosen, that I got to have recovery and find out what my life was supposed to be like. So I think I'm living the life I was meant to live. But unbeknownst to me, when I'd had my aneurysm, my husband, who really didn't have a program all these 9 years that we'd been married, or 10 years, he relapsed on my pain medication. He was holding it for me and doling it out so that, you know, I'd be safe. And he didn't have the support. He didn't have the fellowship that I had that was coming to my rescue. And I didn't find out till probably about 10 months later that he had relapsed, and I was devastated, and I didn't know what to do. You know, I'd always thought, well, if, you know, if my spouse uses, they're out of here. You know, and that's not the case with me. There came a day when it almost came to that. We were at the judge getting a divorce, and several months later, and because it had gotten bizarre, you know, it was 911. For either the way he was acting, the way he was treating me in the house and to our son, it was pretty scary, or that he was ODing on the floor. And jails, institutions, and near death it was for him, and it was in our house, and it was not a pretty sight. And, you know, people encouraged me to, you know, I got a lot of advice. Let me just say that. I got a lot of advice, and I had to just keep in prayer, and I had to save my, you know, you cannot save your face and your ass at the same time. I had to save my ass, you know. I was at a lot of meetings. I was crying at a lot of meetings and telling y'all, you know, what was happening to me. I forget how many years clean I had, probably 12 years clean. And that, you know, life happens. You know, life on life's terms is not always pretty. You know, I'd sailed through my recovery for a lot of years without any big incidents till this happened. And the last 7 years have been not a merry-go-round, but a roller coaster ride. And I'm glad to say that, you know, my husband is clean today, and we are still together. And it's brought us closer. I know that this is a choice I've made, because it's not easy. It's not easy to stay. It's much easier to leave and run You know, and that's what I used to do in my life. I used to, you know, when things heated up, I wanted to run. I didn't want to deal with it. I wanted to back in a corner and hide. And today, I want to face everything and recover. You know, I want to face this life, no matter what it brings. You know, we had to go bankrupt due to the what it cost us financially for the all the stuff that happened, the wrecked cars and the hospitals and the lawyers and all the stuff that's happened. It's just, it's been insanity. But you know what? There's a gift to find in everything that happens. It may, you know, it's a badly wrapped gift. And I've had many badly wrapped gifts in my recovery. And I call that one of them. The other one is that, you know, as we get older, our parents get older. And both my parents had Alzheimer's. And my mom was worse than my dad. And they didn't want to go live anywhere else. They wanted to be in their home. And my brothers and I, we did what we could to get them help in their home and to cover everything and make sure they're fed and all that. And it came a day that, you know, we just couldn't let them live like that anymore because their life was deteriorating. And we kind of tricked my mom into getting her into the nursing home. And my dad was really upset over it, but, you know, we knew that we were doing the right thing to, you know, put her where she was cared for and bathed and fed and taking her medication because she wasn't taking it. She was leaving the house, and we'd find her. We'd get have to call the police to help us find her. And it's not easy to see your parents get like that. And I was the one that had to take her that day to the nursing home. My husband and I had to take her. My brothers were out of town. And what an easy thing, you know. I left there bawling like a baby, and I called my sponsor, and because she'd been through it. I knew she'd been through it with her parents. And, you know, and I got what I needed from that. You know, there's always someone I can turn to in this fellowship that's been through what I've been through. And now I know that what I go through, I've got to give it back. I've got to share. You know, another friend, her dad died recently, and I called and said, you know, I'm here for you. You know, I know what it feels like. You know, my dad, we tricked him into going into the same place with my mom, and he hated it. And, you know, I cared for him more than anyone in the world, you know, other than my son and my husband. The love I had for my parents is just phenomenal. And I would go out to the nursing home every day to be with him and to try to ease his pain and to ease his transition into living a longer life, you know, and being cared for there. He wasn't there 6 weeks, and he hated it. He quit eating. He quit bathing. He kept begging me every time I was there, every day I was there, please take me home with you. You know, I couldn't. I worked. I had a family that is my priority. You know, even though he's high up on my list, I did everything to make sure he was cared for. And his body shut down, and they rushed him to the hospital, and he was in ICU for about 7 days. And through a series of events, I happened to be off work for a week, and I got to spend that whole week with him, going to the hospital every day and just sitting with him and holding his hand and telling him how much I loved him and what a good father he'd been. And he went back to the nursing home, and the next morning they found him without a pulse. You know, he was just ready to die. And this fellowship, you know, one more time came there for me. You know, the flowers, the coming to the funeral, walking me through this. It's not easy. You know, it's not a fun thing. You know, the gift was knowing this man and the joy that he brought into the lives around him and seeing the gift and that he gave people. Yeah, he's gone, and I miss him terribly. And he would be so proud that I'm here tonight. He used to always say, are you still going to those meetings? Are y'all still growing? There's people still doing that stuff? And he used to say, you know, would you give me some stuff? Because I want to go to those meetings with you. But he was a workaholic. He was one of us in that respect. And, you know, you always want to look back and see where the disease came from in your lineage. And it comes out, it manifests itself in different ways. And in his, he was a workaholic. What I love to do today is still give to this fellowship and give any way I can in service. I continue to do H&I. I have no plans on stopping. I'm here with my first sponsor. I'm here with my current sponsor. There's other women that have sponsored me through the years. By the way, right after I found out my husband had relapsed, a friend of mine called and said, "Are you sitting down?" My sponsor that had 18 years had relapsed too. So, you know, you just don't know what cards you're going to be dealt on every day, on any given day. And, you know, I'm so grateful for the tools I've gotten in this fellowship that I don't have to be backed into a corner anymore, that I can look for the gifts and things and face everything and recover. That's what I want to do. The life I've been given is so much greater than anything I could have ever dreamed. And to be up here and to be able to share with y'all that, you know, this program works, you know, and no amount of time takes life circumstances away. There's nothing that's going to happen that I plan on using over. There's nothing that can happen. You know, I have the most awesome son in the world. I can't be up here and not talk about him for at least a minute or two. Since his dad had relapsed, I found a program for him to go to. And that's just been a blessing. It's just, you know, I know that this disease can twist our kids up inside from what they see, what they can see happen. And, you know, I could see it, even though he would say, "Oh, it's okay, Mom, it's okay." I could see it just twisting him up. And so I guess it was about a year and a half ago, I helped start a group in my community that the kids there can go to. That come from families of people like us. And that's another way that I give back. That's not directly to this fellowship, but to my community. And that's important to me. You know, I want to be a respectful citizen today. I got to be the best daughter to my dad before he died. You know, I had not been nice to them growing up. I'd abused that relationship and that love that they gave me. And, you know, I got many years to give that back, and that is such a gift to be able to give that back and give that love back and be there for him. So what I do today is I continue to go to meetings. I continue to do the things that work. I do the things that I learned in the first 30 days, and they still work. I reach out when I'm hurting to the friends I have. The one fellowship, many friends. It's just an awesome awesome theme, awesome fellowship. It gave me my life back. I can't thank you enough. Such an honor to be here. And I love all of y'all. Thanks.